This is Kim Simmons of Savoy Brown, and you're listening to some real good music from a good friend of mine. He called himself the Rockin' Attorney. You know him, Eric Jackson Lurie. He's here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
that Jim Dandy Mangrum still out there touring. Black Oak, Arkansas is touring throughout the great U.S. If you've never seen him live, promise you, it's a show you won't forget. One of my favorites. So you just heard Rest in Peace to the great Kim Simmons. He was a friend of mine and one of the all-time greats on the sixth string. Savoy Brown with Gypsy Healer. Before that, Kristen, first-time caller in Squirrel Hill. Thank you, Kristen. She wanted to hear some Night Ranger. And I said, what do you want to hear? And she said, you pick it. So we went from their last album. Their last album came out just a few years ago. Track was called Dance. Art Garfunkel, Crying in My Sleep. Going out to the memory of the great Terry Lee. He used to spin that on the radio all the time. Three Dog Night for Bob and Carrick. You wanted to hear the live version of One. And we start all off with a request going out to Dr. Kenya Oscar Rodoli with his great show here at the station, Tembo Sounds. He was tuning in. That was the latest from Santana with Smokey Robinson on the lead vocals. Don't Take Your Love From Me. You know, there's so many great shows here at WRCT. And one of them I've really been digging lately. He's been going through the record library and pulling stacks of 45s and just putting on a great show. And talking about DJ Addy, his show From the Basement, broadcasting what's what in alt rock indie, followed by a spread of electronic subgenres. DJ Addy's a cool cat. Fridays, 8 p.m., right here at WRCT. So we're getting near the end of the show. The finish line is in sight. I am thirsty. I am parched. And I'm going to fix that when the show is over. But in the meantime, this is going out to Mike in Highland Park. You want to hear the latest from Mr. Big.
Forever in our hearts. Hold on to those sweet moments. And hear the teardrops start. You're in our You're in our hearts forever.
It's forever.
Forever in our hearts.
Yeah.
satisfied. I just can't keep from trying. Well, I'm all in my sleep. I hear my doorbell ring. I'm looking for my baby. I can't see not a doggone thing. Woman, I'm trouble. Satisfied, and I just can't keep from crying. Well, if I feel tomorrow just like I feel today, I'm gonna pack my suitcase, Lord, make my kid away. When I'm trouble, I've been always mine. Now, ain't no way in the world for me to be satisfied, and I just can't.
WRCT. I can't be satisfied, name of the tune. And I can't stay any longer. They're kicking me out of the studio. I'm going to go deal with my dehydration issues and maybe top it off with some deep fried wings. Sounds good. Something else was good was all the great phone calls tonight, and we got through most of the requests. I got caught up from everything from last week. And we're going to do it all over again next Thursday night at 8. As a reminder, if you missed any part of tonight's show, well, you can catch it again Sunday nights at 10. And for you night owls, at about 1:30 in the morning, Friday morning. Saturday morning, Friday morning, after Viva Lamac, Courts in Session. Let's get back together next Thursday night at 8. Going to close out with a little Southside Johnny and the Asbury Jukes. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, reminding you to take care of each other, be kind to each other, and be proud to be American. Good night, Pittsburgh.
I'm in no hurry, baby. America's Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the deep roots of Trumpism in the American capitalist order.
We speak with returning guest Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report on how we can counter this with independent political action. We then speak with Kashama Sawant, who came from her success as a Seattle City Council member in winning the highest minimum wage in the United States.
She emphasizes her strategy in political action independent of both the Democratic and Republican parties and how that can be the key to success.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
We as ordinary people are experiencing a profound change in the nature of who holds power in America today. Our constitutional democracy, however limited by race and class, is being replaced by an oligarchy, that is to say, the rule by the super-rich few over the many. The separation of powers between the Congress, the executive, and the Supreme Court has all but been eliminated. We are getting what the oligarchs wish for, a unitary executive, where Trump is attempting to rule by executive decrees. He and Musk want to cripple, shrink, and eliminate various governmental agencies that we have won to protect us. This includes the Department of Education, the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Institute of Health, the National Labor Relations Board, and the Social Security Administration. They are perpetuating a hoax, and all they want to do is eliminate fraud and waste and corruption. Don't believe them. Trump has now been in power for 7 weeks. It took Hitler 1 month, 3 weeks, and 2 days to consolidate his dictatorship. After a mentally unhinged person set fire to the German parliament, Hitler got a law passed revoking the German people's civil liberties so they could no longer speak out or organize. Trade unions were banned. Oppositional parties were banned. Then shortly thereafter, he got the infamous Enabling Act passed, which gave him the power to legislate by decree. Opposition by the Democratic Party to the transformation here has been feeble. They welcomed Trump into the White House and pledged cooperation. Despite Trump's falling popularity, more people oppose him than support him, the Democrats have not mobilized people, nor have they come up with a broad program for better wages, jobs, housing, health care, the end of deportations, and opposition to the ongoing Palestine genocide. Here to speak with us today is Margaret Kimberly, the editor of the Black Agenda Report and the author of the book Prejudicial. Margaret Kimberly, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Margaret, the November elections demonstrated that millions of Americans want change. They voted for Trump, who had a record of being a racist, a misogynist, a crook, a con man, and a crude and cruel vulgarian. How do you understand the vote?
There's a couple of reasons. There are people who voted, obviously, for Trump. He won the popular vote this time when he defeated Hillary Clinton. It was in the Electoral College. He actually lost the popular vote. But he, yes, it's true, he won the popular vote. He gained votes from, every time he runs, he gains votes. And, you know, in 2020, he got almost 10 million more votes than he'd gotten in 2016. It was sort of an aberration with many more people voting. But I think it's important to talk about why Kamala Harris lost 6 million votes. She got 6 million fewer votes than Biden got in 2020. Why did so many people who voted for Biden not want to vote for her? I don't think we should focus solely on Trump. He's had this reservoir of support. People continue to be surprised. Millions of people in the country will vote for him despite all the things you have said about him being a con man, having declared bankruptcy 6 times, but marketing himself as a great success. being openly racist, misogynistic, homophobic, transphobic, on and on and on. A man who's, you know, impulsive, who punishes people because they'll say Gulf of Mexico and not Gulf of America. Well, two things. Yes, we should acknowledge that all of those things are, in fact, attractive to many people. There are people who want to be con artists themselves, who want to be able to get away with whatever they want to get away with themselves. They find that appealing. Obviously, there are people who are also racist. I know they people often say, those who are Trump admirers will say, well, he speaks his mind. He says what's on his mind. I think he says what's on their minds. So he is a reflection of a huge sector of the U.S. population. But I think it's important to talk about why so many people who voted Democratic in the past did not do so this time. And I don't think we should overthink it. The Democrats failed to do what they said they would do and what people wanted them to do. So if you'll recall, when Biden first came into office, they knew what people wanted. So they said he was the most progressive president since FDR. They said he was going to cut child poverty in half. Now, these things were not true. He did not, for example, raise the minimum wage, something that would be needed to cut child poverty in half. Even before the midterm elections, they made a big deal out of this legislation, Build Back Better. That would have included a minimum wage increase. That would have included many things that would have helped people who were struggling in the country. And they couldn't get it through because of some Democrats. He had a slim majority. I mean, it was always blamed on Senators Manchin and Sinema, but there's always a Manchin and a Sinema. But I think we have to acknowledge that there is an oligarchy that runs the country. Now it's discussed in terms of Elon Musk and other Trump supporters, but there's an oligarchy, a branch of the duopoly that supports the Democrats. And they've made it clear they do not want to extend any programs, government programs that help people. They don't want that. And they made it clear that they didn't want that. So what would the Democrats do? I mean, there were these silly, they would claim the parliamentarian would, I never heard so much about a parliamentarian in my life. Senate has a parliamentarian. They've always had that role. But suddenly this parliamentarian wouldn't let them do the things they said they wanted to do and people wanted them to do. So the parliamentarian, assuming this person ever said this, I always thought of the conversation going something like this. We can't do this, right? You know, and then the parliamentarian would go along. So we can't, oh, sorry, we can't raise the minimum wage. Then they lost the midterm elections and the COVID programs, which were huge, just disappeared. They had changed eligibility rules for Medicaid, for SNAP benefits, commonly thought of as food stamps. Millions of people lost their benefits. So the Democrats did not do what they said they were going to do to help people. And I believe that was a big reason that Kamala Harris lost. Now, the other reason she lost was this coup against Biden last June after a debate performance made clear that Biden was not up to the task of being president anymore. During the 2020 campaign, many people noticed, myself included, that he seemed to be in a state of cognitive decline. We were told he has a stutter. I'd never heard of Biden having a stutter. Suddenly he had a stutter. But you can't keep hiding things. You can't fool all the people all the time. And that debate exposed, you know, people like me who, you know, are on social media all day looking at these videos. It was clear to me that Biden's health had declined, but this debate exposed for everybody. Democratic funders, remember the oligarchy I talked about, said he has to go. So they tried to engineer this coup against him. It has been said by reliable persons that he was obviously angry about being kicked out. And he endorsed Kamala Harris when Nancy Pelosi and Obama and others had a plan to have an open convention of some kind. But he endorsed her and undercut their plan. And I don't know if you recall, it took Obama a couple of days to endorse her. So I think there is truth to that. So they have Kamala Harris, a weak candidate herself. You know, I think it's a mistake to explain her defeat on, well, people are just misogynistic. Well, people are just racist. Well, there was another biracial person who got to be president of the United States. So I think we can ignore that as an explanation. Misogyny, now people say a woman can never be elected president. I'm not convinced of that, but she was not a great candidate. People called them word salads, where she would look like the deer in headlights or say things that didn't make sense. She did not inspire confidence. I remember her website had nothing on it except how to donate for 50 days. You know, when people run for office, all kinds of offices, local offices, state offices, their campaign website will say the candidate believes in this or doesn't believe in that or wants this or doesn't want that. It had nothing on it for 50 days. And then when something did appear, it was a bad copy and paste of Biden's website. So when there were things like that, which did not inspire confidence. There was a lack of enthusiasm caused by the actions of the Democrats that I have already mentioned. And then, of course, there are people who always liked Trump. I think it's a mistake to be in denial about that, that this man, I don't know of any other personality in American politics who is so well-loved by a large number of people and hated by the other half of the country. But that's what we have. And that's my explanation of how this racist, misogynist, con man, crude crook ended up being elected president again.
Well, Margaret, a number of historians have drawn the comparison between what Hitler did in his first weeks in office to secure his power and what Trump has done in the first weeks of his presidency to secure his power. They do so as a way of demonstrating how Germany was transformed into a fascist dictatorship. Now, while there are surely significant differences between Hitler's actions in Germany then and Trump's actions in the United States today, do you nevertheless believe Trump's actions so far show that he is, in fact, determined to rule, if he can, as an authoritarian, as a fascist?
All we need to do is listen to what he says. You know, he's made these, you know, jokes, quote unquote, about being a dictator and how that would be fine with him. I mean, all we have to do is look at him, look what he says, look what he's done. So, yes, he wants to govern as this authoritarian figure. That is true. But I want to caution us about the Hitler comparison. One of the ways Hitler came to power was the weakness of the liberal class in Germany. And that's what we see now. And I'm not letting Trump off the hook as we watch news of Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia graduate student who was snatched up by ICE, and the government claims he's a threat to national security so they can deport him. We're talking about the right to speak freely, also lies told about him. And they said they were going to take student visas and kick students out of the country, those non-citizens who engaged in protests in solidarity with Palestine. So we can see, and this was at the highest level. This was something Trump said he would do. He's on social media. He said there's more to come. We have executive orders. Presidents have the right to make some decisions by executive order, but there are many legal questions about whether he is usurping the power of Congress. So, you know, for years, conservatives have said they don't want a U.S. Department of Education, for example, and apparently they're going about dismantling it. But the question remains, does president have the power to dismantle a federal agency that Congress created? Of course, Elon Musk and this Department of Government Efficiency, under the guise of saving money, they have fired thousands of federal workers and tried to replace them with AI. So all of these are dictatorial things, but dictatorial acts. However, there's supposed to be an opposition party, is there not? If you can make an analogy with Hitler's Germany, then you have to talk about the weakness of the opposition. In this case, the Democratic Party. His annual speech to joint session of Congress. And what the Democrats do, there's one congressman, Al Green from Texas, who stood up and shook his cane at Trump and said something that Trump didn't like. So they censured him. And there were a few Democrats who joined in the censuring. Some of them refused to clap. Some of them held up these little paddles that said he's lying and things like that. But if Trump is an authoritarian, if he's a fascist, how is that in any way opposition? The speaker, the minority leader of the House, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, lamented that he wasn't sure if he had any leverage. They control everything. He said it's their government. I guess he meant it's their, they control Congress. I thought the government was the people's government. But in any case, and I think the Democrats have been exposed by Trump. Their plan was, as usual, if they happen to be in the minority, was to cut deals and get as much as they can. Their loyalty being to the permanent government and to maintaining the status quo more than it is to speaking up for the people. So we have no opposition to Trump. Congresswoman Tlaib circulated a letter about Mahmoud Khalil and got 13 or 14 signatures. So we have collusion. Everybody talked about collusion with Trump, this alleged collusion with Russia. We have a Democratic Party in collusion with the Republicans, or trying to be. Now, Trump has made it clear he's trying to change the nature of government altogether. So there's no room for them now. So if there's really an analogy with Hitler, an analogy with fascism, we have to talk about the weakness of the opposition.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with Margaret Kimberly, the editor of Black Agenda Report. Margaret, many observers have written about how our constitutional democracy, however limited by race and class, has been supplanted by an oligarchical rule, that the political structure under Trump has been transformed to represent rule by the very rich, that our democracy is being crushed. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you know, it was being crushed before Trump. You know, this oligarchic rule has been going on for decades. Since the 70s, I would say, with Jimmy Carter, the president who recently passed away, who was a very conservative Democrat. And then we went to Reagan, a conservative Republican. And ever since then, austerity has been the order of the day. Austerity, tax cuts for rich people. Under George W. Bush, he passed what was allegedly a temporary tax cut for rich people. Under Obama, who the first 2 years he was in office controlled Congress, this temporary tax cut became permanent. So we've seen this in more subtle ways. We saw Bill Clinton deregulate the financial services industry by repealing the Glass-Steagall Act from FDR era. So if Biden wanted to be the most progressive president since FDR, I guess he could have brought back Glass-Steagall. But in any case, so this is what we've been seeing for a long time now. Trump, it's more obvious with this this very open public partnership with Elon Musk, richest man in the world, sitting in the White House, getting rides on Marine One, which is, I thought, reserved for the president's helicopter, sitting in at cabinet meetings. He's helping run the government. But that's not unusual. Who bailed out Tesla? It was the Obama administration. They gave Tesla huge loans. He helped make Elon Musk such a wealthy man. That's how the system works. So this rule of the rich has been happening for a long time. And the difference with Trump is that he's not trying to hide it.
You know, Margaret, several weeks ago now, you wrote a very interesting article, I thought, for Black Agenda Report on the anti-fascist action taken by the people of Lincoln Heights, Ohio. I wonder, could you please tell our audience about that? I don't think that story is well known enough.
Yes, this happened in early February. Lincoln Heights is a small city of a few thousand people near Cincinnati, Ohio. And there was a march by a white supremacist organization. They hung a banner from an overpass which said America for the white man. This is a majority black town. Residents there took great exception immediately. They interrupted their march. They burned their flags that had swastikas on them. And then they took to the streets armed patrol. Now, Ohio is an open carry state, a concealed carry state. So they were within their legal rights in Ohio to publicly walk around with guns. And they patrolled their neighborhood. I was pointing out, while there are all of these debates about fascism, do we have it, don't we have it, what should we do, all this wringing of hands, and people in this little town decided to take action. They didn't wait for members of Congress or elected officials to give them permission. They didn't ask some public intellectual what they thought about what they should do. They took care of themselves and their community. Now, Lincoln Heights has an interesting history. It was one of the first majority black incorporated towns in the North. But from the very beginning, the surrounding white area, you know, stole land that was supposed to be part of Lincoln Heights. They deliberately excluded the industries that employed most residents. So this town, the population has shrunk. I mean, I'm from Ohio, actually. I was born there, even though I've lived in New York most of my life. And it's the Rust Belt, a state that used to have a lot of industry and high employment and good paying jobs for people. But of course, as finance capital decided that we didn't need industry in the U.S., deindustrializing, sending jobs and industries overseas, mostly to China, black people in that state have suffered. So black people are surrounded by white people who are conservative. Trump has won Ohio every time he's run for president. But the people in Lincoln Heights didn't care about any of that. They cared about self-defense, literal self-defense with weapons. And I know that is not a scenario that can work everywhere, but the reason I thought it was important to give it attention was that, you know, communities know how to protect themselves, in this case, quite literally. And I think there's not enough listening to people at the grassroots across the country about how they want to protect themselves and defend themselves. So we have a need for self-defense politically, and in this case, quite literally. So I thought it was important to point out that there are people who are not waiting, who are taking action on their own.
How do you imagine the late Glenn Ford, your predecessor as the editor of Black Agenda Report, how do you think he would apply his principles of independent political action to today's political situation?
Well, Glenn was a committed socialist. He was a Marxist. And I'm sure he would provide dialectical analysis of the situation. I'm not as well versed as he was, but Glenn always had that cogent analysis, wrote and spoke very often about what we call the black misleadership class, as we see in people like Hakeem Jeffries, who I've already mentioned. He was quite a critic of the Democratic Party itself and its apparatus. So I'm sure Glenn would be providing scathing condemnation of the Democratic Party, exposing their ties to the oligarchy, their dependence on their own oligarchy. But Glenn also was a Black nationalist. So in his class analysis and his dialectical analysis, he would have talked about the needs of Black people. He always put Black people first in the way he analyzed political processes. So I'm not sure, it's funny that that's one of your questions, because I often ask, what would Glenn say about any number of things since he passed away in 2021? I'm sure he would be talking about the need for independent politics, especially for independent politics for Black people, and reminding